I'm someone who loves trying out different makeup looks, but doesn't really wear much on a daily basis, so I like to focus on making sure I have high quality staples. And whether you like a fresh face, full glam, or somewhere in between, you've probably seen Thrive Cosmetics' viral tubing mascara. I've certainly seen it everywhere. You know the one in the turquoise tube? So that mascara, along with all of Thrive Cosmetics' beauty products, are certified 100% vegan and cruelty-free, which I look for in makeup, and they've got excellent quality to match. And something I didn't know from all the mascara videos I've seen is that for every product sold, Thrive Cosmetics donates either that same product, another product that is needed more, or a monetary donation. They've worked with over 500 nonprofits to help with a wide range of causes like supporting cancer survivors, people experiencing homelessness, education access, and so much more. Knowing that makes me feel even better about using their products. And I do enjoy using them. Like I said, I like having high quality staples, and so my favorites are products that are multi-purpose, like the Brilliant Eye Brightener. It comes in a bunch of colors, and I like using them as eyeliner, eyeshadow, and even highlighter. Thrive Cosmetics is luxury beauty that gives back. Right now, you can get an exclusive 20% off your first order at thrivecosmetics.com/thrive. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS. .com/thrive for 20% off your first order. You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
It's time for the Life Writing Podcast with your hosts, authors and screenwriters Stephen Barnes and Tanana Reeve Du. All about creating the project of your dreams while living a balanced artist life. Be the hero or heroine of your own story. Sponsored by LifeWritingPremium.com. Get ready to write for your life.
Welcome to the Life Writing Podcast, where married authors and screenwriter Stephen Barnes
and Tanana Reeve Du talk about writing during stressful times, breaking into Hollywood, and balancing life.
Every week, we'll share more tips on how to build a better life while you create your dream projects.
Even if it's only at the rate of one sentence a day. Life writing is the application of the tools of writing to life and the tools of life to your writing.
Hey, all right. Welcome, everybody. And yes, I know, right? I know. It's so exciting because Steve is back. Steve is back. So yay, back. Welcome back, darling. We missed you here. I held it down. I mean, don't get
yes,
me wrong.
Yes, we did.
We missed you.
You know, the trip to Manila was costly and would have been worth it at 10 times the cost.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I'm sorry I haven't been here, but I am back.
You are back and ready to go. And since you are back, you know what time it is. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on. Let the congregation say amen. Okay. So what is, you turned in, first of all, well, let me let you say what's your big news?
I turned in to Lucasfilm the draft of the Star Wars novel.
Yes.
Glass Abyss.
And, the Glass Abyss.
You know, my sense is that this is the point where I wish I was being paid enough to take another 3 months to finish it. And I had that time and the space to do that. Maybe even just had those 3 months because I can make money doing other things. Because there is, I'm starting to grasp more of what I could do with it thematically. I think it passes the threshold of what it was I wanted to create.
Oh, but it's amazing. It's great.
We can always see additional things we could do, and we probably always will. So you know, at that sure. point, you know, that idea of art is never finished. It escapes.
You know, it's time
for it to escape. It does not belong to me. It was a work for hire. And so if my editor is happy and Lucasfilm is happy and the fans are happy, and if I have passed those thresholds, then I know that the values are there that I appreciate, you know, the things that I want to do. And so the rest of it is praying that because the mythos doesn't belong to any single individual, not even George Lucas. You know, it is mutated into its own thing at this point. My task was to see, given that mythos, could I create a book that I would be proud of separately from all of the image systems that you have to use and put in and the rules and the regulations and so forth. And I think I was able to negotiate that. And I'm really give thanks to my editor for trusting me.
I'm sorry. I can't take it anymore. Your book is amazing. And you're not, you know, yeah, that's all you need to know. Your book is amazing. Not only is it a great Star Wars novel, but it's a Stephen Barnes novel. That's what really impressed me about it, is you were really able to put your stank on it, honey. It feels Barnesian. It feels important to me. So I'm just really, really thrilled that you were able to turn it in under pretty extraordinary circumstances. And good for you, honey. So I just want to say congratulations.
I'll tell you one thing that was unexpected. And that is that I could feel that I was feeling like I was kind of winding up my book writing life, because there was other things I wanted to do. And there are ways in which it made me fall back in love with writing books, because I was able to be goofy, mm-hmm. you know, and I think in my writing, I started taking myself too seriously, you know, wanting to be taken seriously, as opposed to being the goofball that I've always been in my work. So I wouldn't be surprised if getting into my next book is a little easier than it has been, you know, for the last couple. We'll see about that. But anyway,
yeah, I think it will.
What about you?
Well, we just finished a collaboration. I mean, let's hope the editors like it. but I think we did a great job. A short story, really a long story, called The Boatman, for The End of the World as We Know It, the anthology set in the world of Stephen King's The Stand. And no pressure, you know, no pressure to write an amazing story, no pressure to try to impress Uncle Stevie. Just, you know, we just kind of threw a little something together and like, whatever. No, it was really stressful. And also, because this is such a well-known world, there have been two different adaptations of this. The novel has been published twice, two different versions of the story. This is well-trod territory, and there are a lot of great writers contributing stories. So a lot of the pressure was just to try to come up with something that would feel really different, that would both pay homage to King and what we both feel like he gave to us as our unknowing teacher, you know, but also has our sensibilities. And I think we pulled it off. We'll see. We haven't even turned it in yet. So we're probably right after this podcast. But that is pretty exciting. So I'm really happy about that. And now I'm on to working on my novel, the next novel I just sold, which hasn't technically been announced, I guess. So I won't announce it. But y'all, if you've heard me talking about it, it's set in the world of my World Fantasy Award-winning short story from last year. And that pretty much, if you know what that was, then you know what the novel is. But I'm really excited to talk about our next guest. What do you think? What would you think if we did that?
I think we should do that, absolutely.
Because this author is someone who I see a lot in social media, just spreading positivity, like Johnny Appleseed, just absolutely positive, very, very supportive of the horror community. And he's having a breakthrough moment. You know, he just had his novel Children of the Dark reissued. It came out in 2016 originally, but there's a new reissue. So I thought it was his latest book because everybody was talking about it. He's the author of more than a dozen novels, numerous short stories. His work has been championed by authors like Joe R. Lansdale, Jack Ketchum. Oh, poor Jack. I miss him. And Brian Keene, he's also been lauded by Publishers Weekly, Library Journal, and the School Library Journal. Children of the Dark was chosen by Booklist as a top 10 horror book of the year. So please welcome to our show, Jonathan Jantz. All right.
So good to be here. Hello.
It's great to have you here. I don't know why my eyes are watering. I have no idea why. And no one can see this, so I shouldn't have even said anything. But I think I just get eye watery when I get excited. And I was talking about Stephen King and all this and having you on the show. And it's like, it's literally making me cry. It's making me weep from joy. I don't know. But welcome. Welcome to the podcast. I'm really always happy to see people in horror winning. And there's this meme that goes around in social media from time to time, like, horror is back. And I'm like, first of all, did it ever leave? But you are sort of the embodiment of part of that movement, like, horror is back. Your name is just popping up everywhere. The big ones, your work has gained great notice. I've only read Children of the Dark, so I have not, like, experienced the full depth of your work. But that is definitely one of those books that, like, grabs you by the throat and you're like, ah, you know, like, so high octane. I mean, there are moments to breathe, but I just want to be honest about my experience with it too, because I knew you were coming on the show. I really like to read an author before they come on the show. Plus, I wanted to read you anyway, since everyone's talking about you. And I started Children in the Dark, and I don't know if it's considered YA horror, but it has a 15-year-old protagonist. And we can talk about this. What's the difference between YA horror and adult horror, so-called? But it's kind of like the hallways and high school politics portion of the book, right? Where at first I was kind of like, huh, okay, is this book aimed at me? And then it aimed at me directly because it blew up and it was like, wow, this is it. And what you were doing is that thing I tell all of my students to do, all writers, but especially in horror, you can't have fear unless you have real characters. And you were taking your time in the beginning of that book to make sure these characters were real. And they were, and they absolutely were. So let's talk about Children in the Dark, the resurgence of it. How important has this book been to your career? And why did you write it?
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for all that you just said. That is mind-blowing and so gratifying. And I would also say, I know you're asking me questions about me, but I'm currently reading The Reformatory.
Oh.
And then what you said about, like, the characters in my story, that's exactly what I'm 10% in. So I don't want to spoil anything, but people would probably guess there's a reformatory in it. So I don't think that's a spoiler. But they just arrived there. Robert just arrived there with
this. Yeah.
And that, it's like, I feel these characters so deeply. I care about them so much. And in the horror, there are many kinds of horror already in the book, but I think the horror that's not yet been expressed, it's being hinted at, but it's already so effective because I care so much about these kids. I care so much.
I appreciate that.
Robert and Gloria, I love them so much already, and I'm so protective of them. So when I hear about stuff that might happen, I get really, really nervous, and I know that's exactly what I'm supposed to feel. So what you said is what I'm feeling with your book.
Well, but the nerve of you after what you put your characters through. No, I appreciate that. But yeah, it was Children of the Dark is pretty hairy when you care about the characters, and you do such a good job with your young 15-year-old protagonist in that story. Is it considered YA? That's the first question. Is it really considered YA, or is it just a young protagonist?
Yeah, I consider it a young protagonist, but the School Library Journal chose it as a book they really liked, and they called it like a Gone Girl read-alike. And I found that strange because it was a School Library Journal, and Gone Girl is not a YA book at all. But they
just... not to mention that Gone Girl has literally nothing to do with the plot of this story.
Exactly. So I'm not sure how they got there, but I guess I could see how somebody could read. I'll say this. It's the one book in our school library where I teach of mine. So the librarians there feel like it's appropriate for, we have a 7 through 12 And so I guess they feel like it's appropriate for those kids. I never looked at it that way. I just felt like I tried to, just like you do, I tried to get into that headspace and the heart of the character and really feel what Will was feeling. And that wasn't hard for me at all, because a lot of the book is kind of autobiographical. I had a really wonderful mother. So the mom in that book is not like my mom, but the house, the graveyard, the woods, some of the bullying situations just right out of my life. So I think it's one that it was easy to slip into that, because I don't know about you, but I feel like I'm much older now, but I don't feel that much older, and those experiences still feel really fresh from that time in my life. So for me, it's not difficult to channel those and to experience those anew.
I agree with you 100% on that. I love child protagonists. I come back to them again and again. We did it just recently with this story we just finished, because I do remember that time so vividly. I remember the threshold between feeling like a child and feeling like I'd been thrust into adulthood very vividly. And it's just a rich, rich time of life. It's a terrifying time of life. But
it's
also
a great time to write about for a horror story, because it's a threshold on the other side of which is everything that you want. And you're simultaneously often very confident and extremely nervous. You know, you're not ready for the adult world. Your parents aren't ready for the adult world. You know, what is this all going to be? So you talk about, you know, the kinds of thresholds that sometimes are moral that propel one into a horrific situation. I think adulthood is a non-moral, a developmental threshold that can function the same way.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very, very, very true. And, you know, you're both kind of alluding to the deep experiences that kids have but aren't ready for. And I would go back again to the book I'm reading, Tananarive, to the Reformatory. And I think that you can really tell when an author has respect for the younger characters, because it's not a lack of feeling. It's not a lack of emotion. It's just being thrust into these situations without that world experience. And so it's like kids feel things just as deeply, I think, as adults do. They just don't have the emotional wherewithal, nor do they have the experience to draw from. And, you know, in the case of your book and in mine, kind of whatever adult safeguards, guardrails are supposed to be there are taken away because of circumstance. So then they really are thrust into those terrible positions over those thresholds without any kind of ability to cope with them. And I think that's really a wonderful place where horror can occur.
And I think that for me, that nutrient I get from horror is watching the protagonist deal with some sort of an unbelievable situation that they have to rise to face, whether they succeed or not. The point to me is the rising of it. And what is a more daunting situation than being a child learning for the first time, oh my God, these monsters exist? I don't think that's too spoilery to say. Or in the case of the Reformatory, oh my God, this whole system is a monster. And they have no resources and they have no rights. That is a journey. That is an epic journey from powerlessness to power. And I love the way child narrators emerge as leaders, whether or not it's YA. I mean, that is one of the characteristics of YA. But I think if you're writing about children in a horror period, they are going to rise as the leaders because the world is new for them every day. It's like, oh, I got to deal with this now. Whereas adults can't deal. They cannot deal. That's what I think. That's my whole theory about it.
I agree. I think that's very, very true, right? And one of you two mentioned something about like the adults, you know, they don't really know. And that's the thing is like we're supposed to know. We don't know, right?
Yeah, we
know. we're still learning this as we go.
And children hope that their parents know.
Right.
Because if they don't know, well, you know, I think that a lot of religion comes from the fact that we have the experience as children of godlike individuals who produce power and food and shelter from no source that we can understand. So we're kind of set up for that. And when you get cracks in that perception, that can lead to a disillusionment, which is the, you know, the adolescent, you know, mom and dad are stupid thing, until you go out in the world and find out, oh my God, the world is chaos. I can't believe that mom and dad pulled some sort of order out of this chaos. Mm-hmm. So we're kind of set up for it generationally.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think that, you know, kids, like you talked about with their parents assuming that kind of godlike omnipotence and omniscience, when they realize that that's just a facade or that's something the kid has constructed, it almost for the kid, and you're alluding to this, it feels almost like a betrayal. Mm-hmm. It feels like, oh, you were supposed to do this for me and now you're not. And you're nothing. You're kind of a sham. You're a fraud. And I think also when you get into the parent headspace, it's like I sometimes feel like a fraud because I want so badly to solve my kids' problems. I want so badly to have the wisdom and the answers that I feel that they deserve. And I very often don't. I can just do my best. I can stumble my way through it, but I don't do it as nearly as effectively as I would like.
Wow. Let me ask you a question. This is rolling through my mind. There was a little bit of an internet sensation when it was unveiled that you are a whole lie. No, I'm kidding. You've been writing under, no, he's not AI. He's just writing under a pseudonym. And I'm wondering, is that a choice you made in the very beginning or did you swing to it later? Wait, did you start out writing under a pseudonym?
Yeah, one piece of advice that you both have probably heard iterations of a billion times is write like everybody you know is dead. And, you know, I heard Joe Lansdale say that recently, and I've heard other writers say
no, I've never heard that. What does that mean?
I think it just means that you just need to let go of whatever criticism you feel might come from others.
That's great.
Yeah. And I think it was Lansdale that said that maybe in the past year I heard him say it. But I felt when I would sit to write, I would not feel that kind of liberation. I was thinking about, oh my, because being a teacher, I'd be thinking, what are the, and it's weird. I never really worried too much about what my students would say. I just, because you're interacting with your students every day and there's this covenant that kind of forms between you. It's like they trust you, you trust them. After a while, most of them understand that you have their best interests at heart. You're not trying to harm them. You're not trying to mislead them. And I think once you have that, at least for me, it wasn't really the kids I was worried about. It was some faceless parent, because we've all read a lot of books and seen a lot of movies, and we've seen people react to art in a really irrational way. That idea, you mentioned Stephen King earlier, and maybe we can talk about it at some point, but you're talking about your story for that anthology. You described exactly how I was feeling and still feel about the story I wrote for that anthology. But yeah, like King, I've heard so many criticisms of him that are just so outrageous and so horrible and so silly. It's like because something bad happens to a child in Cujo, King must have these terrible feelings toward kids, which is so simplistic and reductive and terrible. But people say all kinds of horrible things about artists. And so in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, because at that time I was teaching at a really small school. And again, really nice people for the most part, but I was really worried, what if some parent picks up one of my books, sees a sex scene or sees vanity or sees whatever it is and starts to judge me and starts to create some campaign against me? Because wilder things have happened.
Oh, right? My gosh. Absolutely. Yeah. Wilder things have happened. Well, recently, the news has been unveiled who you really are. What is your... All right. What is your real name, sir?
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Anna Sheridan, missing for nearly 6 months now.
I need you to find me.
The Sheridan Tapes, a serialized horror mystery podcast. Stream the complete series today on Realm and on all podcasting platforms.
Yes, my real name is Craig Schaefer, and I actually like my pen name better. So I go by Jonathan. I don't know, Craig, the name, there's nothing wrong with the name Chad. It's just a name, but like it almost feels like my kids make fun of that name. Like kind of like people make fun of the name Karen a little bit. They make fun of the name Chad, and it feels like Craig is one of those names of the same generation, like Todd, Chad, Brad, Craig.
It just feels like one of those names. You like being a Jonathan. So people are calling you like colleagues are calling you Jonathan like for years now.
My writing people are, like, you know, Brian Keene and other, like Josh Mallerman, he always calls me Jonathan. And like my manager, my agent, they call me Jonathan. I'm only known as Craig to like my students and my colleagues where I teach at West Lafayette. And then, and of course, you know, my family calls me, my wife calls me Craig.
I would hope so.
Yeah, exactly. But I like my full name is Jonathan Craig Schaefer. So the Jonathan.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So even though I've always gone by Craig, but Jonathan is my real name. So
that actually is, because for me as a Tananarive, trust me, I was tempted. But the idea of people calling me a name that's completely unrelated to my actual name just would be weird. But the fact that your name is Jonathan, that's cool.
Yeah, well, thank you. And then my last name, Jonathan Jans. Jans is my mom's maiden name. And I was raised by my mom and my grandma and my grandpa and my aunt. But it was kind of a way to honor my grandma and grandpa and my mom. And so the Jans was pretty easy to find too. So it's a pen name, but it's a name that feels very like natural. And it was already kind of close to me.
That's fantastic. What made you decide to, you know, basically unveil yourself?
Yeah, I wrote, so I've always used places around me. I've never moved very far. It makes me sound like a yokel. I've never like moved anywhere. I've always lived in the same like 40-mile area. But I always change the names of the places about which I write. So I changed like Delphi, Indiana in Children of the Dark has changed to Shadeland, Indiana. And in where I live now is West Lafayette. But I always change that to other names, like King's Branch in this book called Marla that I wrote is West Lafayette is King's Branch. So I, with this new book that I wrote that I just, the deal was announced recently for Blackstone Publishing called Veil, the sci-fi horror novel that's coming out in 2025. For that book, it takes place not only in West Lafayette, but like at Purdue University, which is about 5 blocks from where I sit right now. So, I use all these places at Purdue, like Mackey Arena, which is where Purdue basketball plays, the Neil Armstrong building. And of course, Neil Armstrong is this iconic figure that went to Purdue. So I used all these real places and the geography is all the same. So I'm like, well, you know, if I'm going to, because I've been having this urge to like let people know, to unify those two things, because it's like increasingly over the years, people have found out, like a lot of my students have found out, a lot of my colleagues. Oh. One of my principals, he's a former principal now, but for a long time, he was my pre-reader. So one of my principals, one of my bosses he'd read everything I'd written. And so he obviously approved of it and thought it was decent. So I just had this growing urge to unveil it. And then, of course, the book's called Veil. And it's like real places. I'm like, this, I just feel like it's time. I feel like it's time to finally let people know. And then I let all the local media know. And so the Purdue newspaper interviewed me and the local TV station. And it's just, I feel like it's been the right time and it's gone, I think, as well as it could possibly go. Yeah.
And no blowback, I assume, from anybody.
Blowback. Yeah, nothing yet. Let's hope that continues. And it's always possible, especially, you know, the atmosphere right now that there's been, for whatever reason, and we could go on about that, I'm sure, but there's been a resurgence in this notion of like banning book, taking books out of libraries, all that stuff. So it's a very real danger. Let's just hope that vortex doesn't find me.
Well, congratulations. If only you could have unveiled your name on our show. But you know,
I won't.
You should have thought of that. Wow. But anyway, I think that's fantastic. When did your love for writing start? And what were some of your early setbacks?
Yeah. So when I was a really little kid, I've always loved stories. I've always loved movies. I started when I was like 8 years old. I made posters. I was a terrible artist, but I made posters for, I was going to do 100 movies. I was convinced that I was going to write, direct, and star in 100 movies when I was older. So I was like 8 years old. I was creating all these posters for different genres of different types of movies. So I always have had ideas. But then when I was 14, I read a Stephen King book for the first time. And you probably heard many versions of this story, how Stephen King introduced somebody. But I read The Tommyknockers, which ironically is like, I think, his least favorite book. He hates
That's
that.
Your first?
It was my first, exactly.
And you kept reading after that? No, I'm kidding.
I know, right? Yeah. I mean, King himself would probably say that. Like, why did you choose that one? But for me, it was just so good. It was this revelatory experience for the first time. And I still love movies. I teach movies, but it was the first time I'd been that connected to a character. It's the first time, and it's the first time I'd felt intelligent. I just really felt unintelligent. I had no confidence. I didn't like anything about myself. So what it started to do was like heal me back into this better mental state. So his books, Stephen King's books for me, did so much more. They entertained me, obviously, but they really changed my perception of myself. I realized I wasn't unintelligent. I was just reading the wrong books. And so when I discovered that, all of a sudden my self-esteem really, I wouldn't say that I became confident, but I became so much more aware of the potential that I had. Now, having said that, you asked about setbacks. I tell my students that I'm the LeBron James of rejection. I got rejected by everybody in basically my 30s. Nobody would publish me. Nobody, no agent would represent me.
Was this short stories, Craig?
Yeah.
So here's a question for you. How many separate works did you have rejected before you got a yes?
So I had several short stories that made the rounds and got rejected, sometimes brutally. There's one rejection that I'll share in a minute after I answer your question. I had, I think it was my third novel that finally got a yes. So I'd written three novels, sent those to agents, sent those to editors, and just gotten mostly ghosted, and then some form rejections. Yeah, yeah. Occasionally there would be a personalized rejection. And you know, it's funny, like those, when all you're getting is rejection, when an editor or agent takes time to like share a reason for it, it can actually be really kind of helpful. Even though you don't want the rejection, I did learn and benefit from those. You know, it is kind of, because they're busy too, right? So it was some generosity on their part. But yeah, I had three books that were rejected until the third one finally got there.
Three books and how many short stories?
I'd say a dozen, probably. Okay.
So you sold approximately your 15th finished work.
Yeah, I think that's.
It's good. I think it's good to quantify that because there are a lot of people feel like unless their first couple stories sell after the first couple of submissions, they can't be writers. And the truth is that the average writer, from my estimation, average writer sells or writes 30 different pieces before they get published. That seems to be the average. And it's important for people to understand that.
So
and
true.
Joe Hill came on here talking about like way more rejection than that. It sounded like just
That's right. How many screenwriters talk about, you know, writing 2 feet of scripts before they sell their first movie?
Right. Yeah. And it's so much tougher too to sell movies. But then was there a moment you felt like, oh, I've made it? It could have been that first publication because we all think that that is world changing and maybe it is. Or was there another moment where you felt like, I'm king of the world? Are you still waiting for that moment?
I think I'm still waiting for that moment. I find here's one, this I might be stating the obvious, but one thing I've learned is that no matter, I know it's not a ladder and I know it's not linear and we're all in different places and have different journeys, but if you imagine it like in a linear as a ladder, every rung comes with problems. Like every, no matter what level somebody has attained, they have problems. And I think that for me, it's this constant roller coaster of like celebrating the successes and then just feeling like I don't know what I'm doing. Some days I just feel like I'm an utter failure, an abject failure. So,
well, you know, if you're not feeling that some of the time, you're probably a hack. Because what you're doing is you're staying within the comfortable. You're staying within what you know you can do. I've done this before. I'll do this again. And that is absolutely the door to destroying your muse.
Wow. That makes sense to me. That makes sense to me. Let me just ask you, you mentioned the Star Wars novel. Had you written for Lucasfilm before?
Yeah, I did. I did one other novel for them 20 years ago, something called The Cestus Deception.
Okay.
And maybe, God, were we married when I wrote that tonight?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Good. Yeah, so The Cestus Deception was written for them, and I was happy with that book. But I think I'm happier with this one. I mean, they asked me to write a Mace Windu novel. So, you know, it was like, the first question when I was, you know, the money was good, you know, the idea was good in general, but the question I had for them was, can I give him a romance? And they said, yes. And so my thought was, well, all righty then. Let me do this. So, you know, in addition to everything else,
he was off to the races.
That's right.
So yeah. the glass Abyss, that has Mace Windu?
Yeah, yes. It's a Mace Windu novel.
Oh my gosh.
He is basically completing a mission that Qui-Gon Jinn died before he could complete. And I will tell you that it is a Star Wars reworking of Yojimbo or a Fistful of Dollars.
Oh, my goodness.
Where he goes to a planet that's being controlled by two sets of gangsters and pretends to be a man with no name in order to get them to play off against each other. And I had so much fun doing it. I made sure that I was having a good time, and almost every page there's something that I laugh my butt off about. Are they really gonna let me do this?
this is really amazing. The guest is interviewing the co-host, and I'm loving it. It's great. But it's a different approach. It's a different approach. Yeah, it is. I can't wait for people to read The Glass Abyss. But with that awkward segue, I was going to ask, Jonathan, why horror? Has it always been horror for you?
Yeah, it really has. My mother she's always like watched TV shows like The Twilight Zone and Leonard Nimoy's In Search Of. I don't know if you ever heard of that one.
Oh, wow. That's a deep cut, that one.
Yeah. In search of Bigfoot, In Search Of Aliens, whatever. And so she's always loved things like that. And then she also, I know this dates me, but she would go to the library and bring back albums, like books on albums, stories on albums. Like that's how, so we would listen to like Edgar Allan Poe. I was like 5 or 6 years old listening to The Telltale Heart and listening to The Black Cat. Yeah. And so The Pit and the Pendulum, I remember that. I remember just envisioning that blade descending. And I remember being so scared as a little kid, but also completely immersed in the story. So I think that the fact that my mom loved that kind of story, the fact that it was often on either the record player or the TV, the fact that we lived by the graveyard and the woods were behind us.
You were doomed.
I was doomed. I had no choice. It had to be horror. Yeah. And I don't, and I'm the one quick thing for Steve, I was just going to say that the Mace Windu, I lit up because my daughter and I, my youngest daughter, we went to Hollywood Studios in Florida and she built a lightsaber and she is so fascinated by the Mace Windu character. And she frequently will talk about ways to, this is a spoiler for Revenge of the Sith, I guess, but she talks about ways. She's like, well, Mace, I think he's alive. I think he can be in more Star Wars shows. Like she's just
Sam Jackson is convinced he's alive. I mean, we've seen that Jedi can virtually fly, so tossing him out of a window isn't going to kill him.
Right. Okay. I'm sorry to keep derailing us, but I just wanted to
say, it's fine.
This is awesome. It's awesome that you wrote that. That's so cool. All right. I'll stop.
It's meant to be, clearly. So
there are zombies.
It's in the Force. Yeah, he had a good time. He had it. And I had a good time reading it too. Just like I had a good time reading Children of the Dark. See that segue there? But so. Horror, you know, this just strikes me again and again, and you kind of embody this for me, Jonathan, because you do seem to be such a nice guy, and the horror community is so supportive. And Victor Laval came on our show some time ago and talked about how he finds the horror community to be much more of a welcoming and nurturing community than the one he came from previously, which was just literary fiction. And I wanted to talk to you about that because it seems to me that the horror community is even getting tighter. Like there's a stronger sense of a bond, in part fueled probably by social media. Also, horror is having a kind of renaissance in the sense that it's become much more diverse. A lot of new readers are coming in, a lot more respect for the genre, certainly than when I was in college. What are your feelings about the horror community right now? Why are we so awesome?
I just watched your Victor Laval episode about an hour ago, and it was awesome. And he's a fantastic writer and a great person. I was on a panel with him, and I forgot to participate because I was listening to him. He's so good.
He is good.
He's so good. But yeah, I think for the exact reasons you stated, you know, you mentioned that the online presence of a lot of us, like you're online, and that's just another thing too, Tananarive. It's like you online have you just exude so much joy, and it's you come from a place. Mallerman and I talk every day, and we talk about coming from a place of magic, and you do, like you have that ability or whatever it is, whether it's innate, whether it's something that you cultivate and nurture, whatever it is, you have that magic, and it really shows. It's a very authentic, sincere energy.
I've never heard anybody say that other than me. You're absolutely correct. What I've said is that she is better prepared for her life in some ways than any human being I've ever met. I would attribute that to her family, her community, and they found the magic inside this little girl named little Tananarive, and they built her world around that. She never had to step away from her magic to feel like she was loved and supported.
That's so true.
And it's, you know, that is what a gift that her parents gave her. I mean, just a magnificent gift. We could only all give that to all of our children.
Yeah. And maybe that's what we have to arm ourselves with. To sort of be the scouts who were going down into the caves and bringing up these tales of terror.
Yeah.
Because I know for me, I find it very healing. And I want to be in a place of joy. I want to stay in a place of joy. I'm very disappointed on the mornings I wake up and I'm not feeling completely in joy. And I think writing horror is a big part of what helps me do that, because I can funnel all of that toxic stuff into an imaginary story that makes it more palatable than the real crap, you know, that's in the headlines. Is that how it feels for you?
It absolutely is. Yes. It's cathartic. It makes me, if I'm not writing, I'm not as emotionally healthy. Mm-hmm. Like it just builds up and I need to do that. And I feel so good when I'm able to express. And that's why I tell my students, it's like, you know, the moment you put pen to paper or fingers to keyboard, you're doing something positive. You are getting emotionally healthier. And I feel like it does so much. It does something for others, but it does something for us as well. This is totally atypical and you can say no, and it would only be like six lines. Would you mind if I read six lines of your book really fast?
What? Oh my gosh. Okay.
Drag me into the briar patch.
How can I refuse? I guess.
My reason why is because you talked about her family and about how they surrounded her with this love.
That's
I got choked up the other night. I get choked up just talking about this because I was reading this passage about Papa. And anyway, here we go. Here's what it says. This is from early in the book, so it's not a spoiler. Papa in Chicago was a different thing entirely. They needed him now. Papa had fled to Chicago, and she did not know when or if he would send for her and Robbie. He said he would try to bring them to Chicago by fall, but it wasn't certain, and fall was months away. She couldn't hear his laugh or feel him nearby when she heard night noises outside her window. Like that, I just, when I read that part, it's like the love, it reminds me of Dandelion Wine by Ray Bradbury, and I call that book Love on Paper. But like the love that is expressed there from Gloria to her father, the longing she has to be with her father, his presence, it was like I was reading that and it was my grandpa. Like I lost him about 3 years ago.
But, I'm so sorry.
But you know, like we love, like these people are so special to us, but that's so hard to authentically articulate and then express and put on the page. But like that passage is just love on paper.
You and have like, to suspend your cynicism.
Yeah.
I knew Ray well enough to say that he was emotionally a simple man, intellectually quite complex. But emotionally, he was a little boy who was still absolutely astounded that he'd been able to spend his life surrounded by dreams and dinosaurs and friends who saw him and allowed him to be who he was. He really was that guy. And you know, anyone who thinks that all art comes from pain is wrong. Art comes from strong emotion. Pain is one of those strong emotions, but love is just as powerful.
This is so beautiful. First of all, if you're going to be reading passages from my work, just come on the podcast every week, Jonathan. No, but yeah, it's trying to express life and the truth of life through lies, because all fiction writers lie for a living, but it's lies that are in service to creating the truth, if that makes any sense. And that's what I think we're striving to do all the time. What truth are you trying to convey over and over in your work? Do you see recurring themes? What are you trying to express?
One thing I think that we, just as we talked about as adults and you know whatever, we talk in parents, we talk about continually feeling like we fail, but at the same time, that helps us to be self-aware enough to try not to fail the next time or not fail as badly. And I think that like as a writer, one lesson that has recurred to me, like I forget this lesson and then I remember it and my work is better, is like, you know, sometimes you'll have characters motivated, and this goes to what you said, Steve, characters can be motivated by all kinds of things. They can be motivated by revenge. They can be motivated by hatred. They can be motivated by prejudice. They can be motivated by all sorts of things, money, whatever it is. But I think the most powerful motivation is love. And when I remember that, when I remember that the most powerful force, I think, in the universe is love, and the most powerful motivation is love, my fiction is always richer for it. And I think love is at the heart of most good fiction. It's certainly at the heart of my favorite books, the heart of the favorite books that I've written. You know, you talk about Children of the Dark. To me, the emotional core of that book is Will, his love for his little sister, who's six. And, you know, even though I didn't have a sister, I do have three children. And so I know what that's like. And then I also see their bonds. As much as they hate each other sometimes, they also care about each other. And so I just feel like that motivation, I feel like that is more powerful than anything that life can throw at us. And maybe that sounds naive, but I genuinely believe it.
No, but that sibling bond, because that sibling bond is also the core of the reformatory. And it is such a precious and delicate thing, like just the absolute terror when we're reading books about siblings that something's going to happen to one of them. I can't stand it in horror movies when family members get killed, like that Camping in the Woods story where there's like siblings and parents. If one of the children dies, oh, it's so traumatic to me. So that is beautiful. That is great. You mentioned your family. So you have a busy job because you're a public high school teacher.
Correct.
You have a family with three kids, and you have this double life as a writer. How do you balance all of those things? That's kind of the core of our show, is that life art balance.
Yeah.
If writing is what you use to get on balance, then what is your second go-to? If you're writing,
yeah, good catch,
and feeling
good catch.
Unbalanced, you don't want to just do more writing to get balance. What do you do? Maybe, you know, get a hug or play with a kitten or, you know, any number of different possibilities.
Yeah, I think the probably the writing would be the second thing I feel like I go to for balance, honestly. My family is the first, and I try, yeah. So I'm a pretty, like my life is, I think it sounds boring to other people, but I really have like three main things in my life. I have my family that always comes first. I have my teaching, and I feel like because I'm a teacher, I owe it to my students to prioritize them over my writing. And that's just because of time. You know, maybe if I taught different hours, it wouldn't be like that, but I'm with them for most of the day. So I feel like when I'm with them, I really need to be with them. So I write around my teaching schedule and around my family's schedule. And so anytime I'm not teaching or with my family, then I'm writing whenever I can. I'm writing or screenwriting, one of the two. So yeah, I go to my family first because that's the place. Like if I feel like I'm failing at writing, that's painful. But if I feel like I'm failing at my family, then that's just like unbearable. And we all have moments where we feel like—
That's devastating.
It is. And like moments where we feel like we should have been more present. Right. Yes. Did I really need to check my phone right there? Or should I maybe have left that phone upstairs so I could engage with my daughter or my son and talk about it? Today, right.
How old are your children?
This is cool. They're seventh grader, sophomore and senior. And this is the year they're all three in my building. So I have all three of my kids at work with me, which is just so special and so awesome. It's just
for you. No.
One thing that happens is your students probably know that you're being authentic because your kids are there, you know, to gut check, you know, everything. So there are going to be some disadvantages to that, but there's some real advantages too. I mean, that's life.
And, you know, I'm kidding about them not wanting you to be in the building with you. But how do your kids, A, feel about being in the building with you, but also about the fact that now everybody knows who you are and what you do?
Yeah, I think they, for them, like their friends all knew that I was a writer before this because they come over to our house and they see my books on the shelf and stuff like that.
Okay.
So I don't know that it was too much of an adjustment for them when that news came out. If it has been, they haven't said it. That's always possible, right? But yeah, I think like for me to be a teacher at the school, I don't want to sound immodest, but they've always reported like very positive things about that. And they keep taking...
Good.
Yeah, and they keep taking my classes, and they're elective classes mostly, so I have them in my elective classes, and I feel like that's the thing. It's like, there's a movie called 310 to Yuma with Christian Bale and Russell Crowe, and it's one of the movies I show in Film Lit, and in that movie, at the beginning, Christian Bale's wife and one of his sons have kind of lost faith in him. And I always pause it there and I talk about how, and it's probably, I'm not unique in this regard, but it's like there are a few people in our lives that if they think highly of us, we'd rather have that and everybody else in the world think badly of us than the reverse, right? It doesn't matter if 7 billion people think I'm a good guy if those four people, my wife and my kids, think that I'm a fraud or think that I'm a bad person. So, you know, I try very hard to be authentic with my students, but obviously with my own children. And I feel like for the most part, they feel like it's a good thing that I'm a teacher there. And like, they still come by the classroom and see me, which is super cool, exciting. Yeah.
You have a great relationship with your kids. I know there are a lot of parents listening to this going, are you kidding me? So good for you. And you mentioned screenwriting earlier. I can't let that reference go, because part of the whole theme of this podcast is about prose writers transitioning to screenplays. I'm assuming you were writing prose first, and then did you get interested in screenwriting because people were trying to option your work, or was it completely separate and you just always wanted to do it?
Yeah, there was that desire, like in the back of my mind, because I've always loved movies. When I was three, I saw Star Wars. I've been in love with movies ever since. Mm. So that desire was always there, but I always doubted my ability to do it. Partially because it just didn't, I don't know, for whatever reason, I didn't sit down and try to write one. So the real turning point was Ryan Lewis, who's my manager for TV and film and Josh's manager. And Ryan was an executive producer on Bird Box. We started talking with Children of the Dark, actually, because there was interest in Children of the Dark from a really big studio, but like so many things, it didn't go anywhere.
Of course, yes.
Right, we know like that. That's so more frequent than the success stories. But I was, Ryan said, are you interested in like adapting your own work? And my answer was, well, I am, but I don't know if I could do it because I don't know how to do it. And Ryan's answer was just really simply said, I'll teach you. And that's his attitude. He's just very positive. He's like going back to, he's like Obi-Wan and Yoda kind of rolled into one. And he's just always there. There's a way forward. It's hard. Yes, it's work. And I'm going to like push you. And he always like, we'll spend an hour on a single line to try to make it better. But wow. he has mentored me so much. And I'm also, again, nobody's totally self-aware, but I'm objective enough to know that, okay, this is only like my third year as a screenwriter. So I'm not going to be as good at this yet as I am at writing prose. And it's going to take a while. Like it's going to be a while before I am what I can become, but I've got to keep at it and all that stuff. And we're on the third one now. We're on the third adaptation right now of my work. And the first two were shopped and there's been some interest, but no sale yet. But that's
okay. Oh, you're writing them spec.
So I'm adapting my own work. I'm actually with somebody else that Ryan introduced me to starting to, and I'll tell you all who this is after our podcast is over, because I don't know if he wants me to say anything. We're actually developing something new that's not from my work. Like we're developing a novel that's going to turn into a screenplay and I'm going to write both, but it's not from one of my pre-existing books. So totally different.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay, we'll hear all about that. And then we'll dish about the director who just texted me during this podcast, because he's about to get attached to our pitching for the Reformatory. So Steve, he wants to talk to us. He's excited. I guess they must have reached out to him, Steve. So anyway, that is incredible. Awesome. And mentorship is the key. I mean, right there, that is why people say Hollywood is relationships, which is another way of saying Hollywood is who you know. But the good news is you can get to know a lot of different people. So really, I think the more legitimate way to say it is Hollywood is based on relationships. And you're very lucky, because there have been times in the not so distant past when the author is the last person producers want at the table to adapt their own work because of that learning curve. But I happen to think that when writers do learn how to write screenplays, they can, in a much shorter period of time, bring themselves up to a professional level, because they've already been through that process once with storytelling. It's just the difference of using more visual symbols and learning how to write dialogue differently and learning how to express the story in images and, you know, this kind of thing. But once you can figure it out, and it's a steep learning curve, and I feel like I'm learning, but I also can feel that we're getting much better at our scripts.
The most important exercise that we give students in terms of learning how to write scripts is to have a Saturday night movie night, and you get a script of a movie that you've already seen, and you watch the movie and read the script at the same time. And you will, you know, within a year, you'll create that mental connection between what's on the stage, what's on the page, and what's on the screen, and what it is that you have in your head, and what you need to write on the page in order to make it to the screen in that way. It works really, really well.
Yeah. Awesome. I'm rooting for you, because of course, as a member of the horror community, we're always rooting for each other. A win for one is a win for all. If you haven't seen Late Night with the Devil yet, you've got to see it. Oh my gosh, it is so good. Yeah,
I felt genuinely uneasy driving home from that.
He was creeped out in the car.
Wow.
Yeah, about two-thirds of the way through the movie, I realized, oh my God, they've got me. They were under my skin. I have to watch it again to figure out how did they do that? What was the moment? I think it might have been when they were going back and forth between the levels of reality, the you know, what we're seeing of the archival footage and then the behind the scenes video. I think that after they'd done that a couple of times, I lost my moorings.
It's immersive in that way.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, obviously it's great. It'll be streaming on Shudder in April. But if you live in an area where you can see it in a movie theater, I think that seeing it in a theater is a very important part of the experience. Okay. Because it's late night. There's a studio audience. And guess who's the studio audience? We are.
Or see it with friends. Because it is, after all, about a television show. So seeing it on a television screen in your living room should be an interesting experience.
That's true. That is true. Because I think it is a limited release, so not everyone will be able to see it in a theater. But if you can do that, Jonathan, it's been so awesome talking to you. Where can people find you in social media and online? How do they get in touch with you?
Yeah, so I jonathanjans.com is where you can find my website. And I'm pretty active on Twitter, on, I guess, Threads. You and I interact there a little bit.
Yes.
Instagram sometimes. So I'm at most of the places. So, and I love to interact with people. And yeah, so please, if you are interested, I'd love to be friends there and talk.
He really is. He's great. A great, positive, shining light in social media. Wherever you are in your writing journey, whether you're still taking your first steps, you've just sent out your first stories, you're getting your rejections, even after you've made your sale, Steve and I have a Life Writing Premium program that is meant for all writers at all levels, where you get digital download courses, lectures, essays every week. You could consider the course almost like an accountability partner. Like every week you're reminded, oh, that's right, I'm supposed to be writing.
and for those of you who are willing to do the work, then I will say this bluntly. Our guest tonight said that it took him about 12 to 14 stories, pieces of writing, to get published. Not one of our students has taken more than 24 stories. If you've got the heart to actually buckle down and do the work and follow the advice, we can come so close to making you a promise that you can get published. I can do that because no one who is sincere will go through that many stories without seeing their work getting better and better and better. So if you understand that we're not exaggerating, but being a little bit optimistic that you're not going to be the one that falls off a cliff, that we'll be there to help you every step of the way. We even have a community where we meet live on Saturdays. You can find out about that by connecting with StephenBarnesList.com or TananarivList.com.
Just TananarivList.com.
Yeah, TananarivList.com. So join us on the Life Writing Premium Program, please.
www.lifewritingpremium.com. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you to Jonathan Jans for being such a great guest. You all go out and make yourselves the hero or heroine of your own story.
The hero in the adventure of your lifetime.
Bye-bye, everyone.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Life Writing Podcast. Join us next time for more conversations about creating the project of your dreams. For more information, go to lifewritingpremium.com and get ready to write for your life.